I want to start out by reading the Loka Vipata Sutta, The Failings of the World, it's translated. The way I learned it was the Eight Worldly Winds. And it just starts out, monks, these eight worldly conditions spin after the world, and the world spins after these eight worldly conditions. Which eight? Gain, loss, status, disgrace, censure, praise, pleasure, and pain. For an uninstructed run-of-the-mill person, there arises gain, loss, status, disgrace, censure, praise, pleasure, and pain. These also arise in a well-instructed disciple of the noble ones. So what difference? What distinction? What distinguishing factor is there between the well-instructed noble ones and the uninstructed run-of-the-mill person? He goes on to say, gain arises for an uninstructed run-of-the-mill person. He does not reflect, gain has arisen for me. It is inconstant, stressful, and subject to change. He does not discern it as it actually is. His mind remains consumed with the gain. He welcomes the arisen gain and rebels against the arisen loss. As he is thus engaged in welcoming and rebelling, he is not released from sorrows, lamentations, pains, distresses, or despairs. He is not released, I tell you, from suffering and stress. Now, gain arises for the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones. He reflects, gain has arisen in me. It is inconstant, stressful, and subject to change. He discerns it as it actually is. His mind does not remain consumed with the gain. He does not welcome the arisen gain or rebel against the arisen loss. As he thus abandons welcoming and rebelling, he is released from the sorrows, lamentations, pains, distresses, and despairs. He is released, I tell you, from suffering and stress. And then, as so often happens, the Buddha broke into poetry, and here is a stanza that I think sums it all up pretty well. Knowing this, the wise person, mindful, ponders these changing conditions. Desirable things don't charm the mind. Undesirable ones bring no resistance. So this is not one of the suttas where you chew on it and go, okay, I've got it. This is a practice instruction. This happens, and then do this. So I'm going to start kind of at the beginning with the easy ones, pain and pleasure. I just had 2 weeks of almost uninterrupted pleasure on a cruise to the Mediterranean and the Adriatic. Saw a lot of things I've always wanted to see. And it was really hot. It was so hot, it was hard to get the clothes off when we finally got back to the cabin and the air conditioning. I had a wonderful time, heat notwithstanding. So, pain and pleasure happen constantly. So we have a lot of opportunity to practice. For example, with the pain, on retreats, the teachers really emphasize working with the pain because, you know, it happens all the time. you're sitting in this one position, and you know, if you're over the age of 20, things will start to stiffen up. The knees will get a little cranky. So the teachers will say, notice how the pain changes, how you react to it, and how it passes away. These things that Buddhist teachers instruct when meditating with pain comes right out of this sutta. We're being asked to notice the changeability, the stress, and the impermanence of pain. Pleasure is a little more subtle, a little, sometimes I think, harder to work with, but very important, because impermanence is exactly where the suffering lies when it comes to pleasure. So this practice is vital in holding pleasure lightly. I like to use the analogy to holding a butterfly that has landed on your hand. You grasp it, you've destroyed it. And so I always knew that cruise was going to end, and I could be thoroughly with every moment of the pleasure, and only had a little twinge when it was over. Gain and loss get even more complex, but they're still pretty easy to observe. I get something, I like it, I want to keep it. So as you can see, we're looking at attachment here and at how it works, and we're looking closely at how we can work with these forces that are beyond our control that can change things in any moment. We have very little control over things that come into our lives, into our possessions, and then they're gone. They change, they disappear. When you've lived in one place for 20 years, you get a lot of opportunity to practice with this, because everything goes through a process of obsolescence, from towels or curtains to the paint job on the house. Everything is going to go and have to be replaced. Then there's the very early model of a Kindle that I left on the airplane coming home. So there went the $50 I paid for it, and until I replace it, I have to actually read books, you know, with paper and stuff. In both of these simple forms of luck, things going well, things being lost, there's a very subtle sense of I, me, and mine that takes the momentary sting of loss and stretches it out, amplifies it. As I said about the Kindle, I initially focused on what it cost me, the inconvenience I will have. And because it was mine, I had to deactivate it in order to protect my data with Amazon. So it wasn't a big loss, but I was able to see loss has arisen. It's going to change this feeling. It's got some stress in it, and it's going to go away. And its power lies in the fact that I thought of that Kindle as mine. So the next couple of pairs of these worldly winds, I'm going to use the translations that I learned 20-some years ago, and I'm going to call them Praise and Blame. Tanisiro Bhikkhu translated them originally as Censure and Praise for Praise and Blame. And then I'm going to use the terms Fame and Ill Repute. You know, they're all very close synonyms. And either way you translate them, they're just packed with the sense of self. There's just a lot of I, me, and my in them. So I'll ask you, have you ever done anything quite innocently and had no ill intent whatsoever, but it went awry very badly, and you ended up with someone criticizing you, someone angry with you, blaming you for doing whatever it is? It's so easy to do with language, and particularly online. We do it so often. We just rush through that email, and you never meant to use a phrase or a word in a derogatory meaning, but it had that meaning, that alternate meaning, and that's what was read by the people that you sent that email to, and now you're getting some real blowback. And, you know, it hurts. You have literally put your foot in your mouth, regardless of your intention. And it's time to pause and look inside at how it feels to have those people angry with you, to be blamed. Forget the story. Doesn't matter what you meant. You're getting blamed. And this can happen with actions too, not just with language. I was driving on the freeway and found myself following a motorcycle cop in the fast lane. And because he was there driving the speed limit, all of the traffic slowed down except for an SUV in the far right lane who was just zipping by everybody else, including the cop. And moments later, the lights on that motorcycle started flashing, and off he went to the right. And I assumed he was after the SUV, and I kept going. And I thought nothing more of it until those lights were behind me. And I got a ticket for passing a policed vehicle with its lights on, or passing through a traffic break. And I never recognized it as a traffic break until I saw it in my rearview mirror. I had no idea that what I had done was wrong. But now I got a ticket. And it brought up a lot of unpleasant feelings. There's definitely some loss, you know, because it's expensive. And then there's going to be the insurance consequences and anger. It brought up anger because I was innocent, for Pete's sake. But what really bugged me was the blame. I now have an official piece of paper saying that I have done something bad. And I felt falsely accused and a little indignant. And I especially felt the sting of knowing that that cop held me in low esteem. He may be the only person on earth that feels that way. Maybe the judge will, because I'm taking it to court. But we'll see. So where was my practice in all of this? Well, first, it was watching what was going on inside me. During my pleasant conversation with the motorcycle CHP officer, and subsequently. And it took a while for all of these feelings to go through their dance. And I have to tell you, as each feeling arose, I actually did reflect. Loss has arisen. Anger, blame has arisen. Not exactly in those words, but you know, I was aware of it. I was reflecting on it. And it is so important in the first place to acknowledge these feelings, to bring them to conscious attention. Because otherwise, how can we possibly work with them? So the next reflection that the Buddha prescribed for us is key to escaping continuing suffering. With each of these feelings, I reflected loss or anger or blame has arisen. It's inconstant. I knew that it was changing. And I reflected, it's stressful. I knew that it hurt. It wasn't comfortable. And it's impermanent. It's not going to be the rest of my life with this feeling. So rather than remaining engaged in rebelling against these feelings and the distress and despair that such feelings can become, I abandoned them. Not like this. They didn't go away just because I wanted them to. But that is the language of the sutta, and it's about letting go. It's about renunciation. It's, well, what happened inside me was that I kind of stood back and just let the feelings go through and fade on their own time. And I was confident that they would, because I knew that this was a phenomenon that was impermanent. Very importantly, in the meantime, I didn't feed them by rebelling against them. It did take the blame a little longer to fade away, largely because I decided immediately that I was going to contest it, and I wrote down everything that I remembered. I wrote it down while it was fresh. So I stayed in the story a little longer. I simply wasn't able to just abandon it right away. But once my signature was dry on the declaration, It was a great relief. It could go. Just the way the Buddha promised in the sutta. You work it, it works. So this is a practice of noticing feelings as soon as possible and remembering the Dharma, the truth of impermanence. The feelings are impermanent, stressful, and subject to change. It's sort of like that irritating phrase that people tell you when you're stuck in some kind of suffering, this too shall pass. It's true. And it's so much more useful if we can remember that ourselves without having to be told. This is part two of Worldly Luck We Can't Control, or by another name, the sutta called Lokavipatti. This sutta is often considered a teaching on equanimity. It goes beyond the practice of repeating the Brahmavihara phrases, such as metta phrases. The traditional phrases for equanimity recall that each person has to let go of attachments for themselves. We care about them, and we wish them peace and freedom from their suffering, but we can't achieve that for them. What can we do for ourselves? Well, there are concrete instructions in the Lokavipati Sutta. These instructions, as I covered last week, work for pain and pleasure, gain and loss. They also work for the more complex social world that we inhabit. Even the monks that the Buddha was addressing. Getting along with others is a matter of survival for almost all human beings. We're the top predators because we cooperate, and this lets us provide the necessities for the whole group. But this also means that the animal most dangerous to any of us is another one of us. So we take praise and blame and good or bad status very seriously. The problem is that we don't, as the Buddha said, discern it as it actually is. In the poem at the end of this sutta, the Buddha said, "Knowing this, the wise person, mindful, ponders these changing conditions. Desirable things don't charm the mind. Undesirable ones bring no resistance." So pleasure and gain have a dark side because of impermanence, because they'll go away and leave us sad that we're no longer in this state of pleasure or having what we had gained. This dark side is also true for praise and fame. These are intangible things that are attributed to us by other people. I mean specifically human beings, because your pets don't count. If we could only be who our dogs seem to think we are, and if only others could all see us the way we like to see ourselves. But have you ever known someone who thought so highly of you that it was scary? Teachers sometimes get this. And sometimes it'll happen in the early stages of romance. And it feels a little like being locked inside a mold of yourself. Any moment you can break that mold, and you'd have to watch that illusion shatter in someone else's eyes. Even when you have a reputation that's well-deserved and based on facts, it's stressful, subject to change and temporary. I was a very hard-working, conscientious lawyer. I won a bit more often than I lost in court. I had strengths and weaknesses, but I did the best I could, and I had a pretty good reputation among lawyers, judges, and clients. I tried not to think about it too much, but there was stress because I knew I could make a misstep, a mistake, or be misunderstood, and there would be repercussions. Some were serious. Lawyers face sanctions in court, including fees and jail time, or lawsuits by clients that include malpractice and possibly even disbarment. So yeah, a good reputation, but still stress. And the reputation did change. Illness took me out of the game, and I was forgotten amazingly fast. It was kind of breathtaking. And now those who have remembered me are all out of the game themselves. Sick, retired, or dead. that hard-earned reputation has dissolved into thin air. It hasn't bothered me much, particularly because I began this practice within months of leaving my partnership. Now that I don't know anyone who's still lawyering from those days, there's an eerie feeling of invisibility. But when I notice that and reflect on impermanence as a characteristic of all our experience, I actually feel an abandonment of self in it, and it has a light, free kind of joy to it. No reputation, no worries. No self, no problem. With all of the eight worldly winds, it's vital to remember it's not me, and I only harm myself when I take it personally. That's how we get consumed by these worldly winds, how we chase after them, by letting the sense of self get attached to what comes and goes, what's blown into our experience and what's blown away. Shortly after I started meditating and working as well with the 12 steps, I became painfully aware of what I called the backlash of the self. It happened every time I was praised for something, and it felt really good. I felt really good about myself. Inevitably, though, something would happen to shatter that rosy image that I formed of myself. And I always paid dearly for that swollen ego, because my self-image then was so low that it felt like being held in a dungeon and tortured regularly, all by my own mind. I had let praise or blame take over my attention, and I was consumed by both the good and the bad images that I believed others had of me. I forgot praise and blame are just luck and not my doing. It just happens. It just arises. Now, as I just wrote in my monthly blog the other day, what we can do is be honest and ethical and kind, and then just hope for the best. These social worldly winds are, I think, the hardest to practice with, especially when we're praised or held in high repute. We so want to think it's because of who and what we are, and not because of the way other people just happen to be thinking. Because we have almost no control over what other people are thinking. In fact, we can't even know what they're thinking. They can say one thing and believe something entirely different, and we don't know it until we happen across it on Facebook or wherever. There's a saying that has helped me a lot over the years, and that is, what others think of me is none of my business. We can put on a show hoping to make them think well of us, but they might not be watching, or they might see it very differently than we intend. People will just think what they will. It's as uncontrollable as the wind. So our practice is to notice when we're happy because we've been praised, or we have a whole lot of Facebook friends or some kind of following. Notice it and remember its impermanence and the stress that's inherently a part of it. We don't have to sabotage any praise or good reputation that we get. But we need to discern the drawbacks that are intrinsic to it and give up being glad about getting them or letting them consume us. Just remember not to feed the ego this kind of sugar. It will make us sick and will inevitably suffer. To practice this way is hard in our culture because it worships fame. I've always felt uncomfortable about this celebrity obsession that Americans have. And it made living in Los Angeles for 4 years pretty awkward. A town is just obsessed with celebrity. And everyone, even if they don't claim to be trying to be an actor, they love to drop names. But it isn't just in Hollywood. It's from everywhere, and it goes back to antiquity. The Greeks almost worshiped their heroes. Achilles had to be the son of a goddess because he was so powerful in battle. It was superhuman. We just love the superlatives in famous people. This obsession with fame almost seems to be built into our genes. And a lot of us do get to the point where we realize we're just not really going to care if we're never famous or rich. There's, you know, sort of, I may never be rich or famous, but. And I have looked at so many famous people who have handled their fame really badly and sometimes disastrously. That for me, that but leads to, but I'm happy. Not wanting to be famous or share the glow of someone who is means that we have escaped an illness common to our species. So let's focus on handling praise or blame and a good or bad reputation as the Buddha suggests. 1, acknowledge your feelings. Don't hide from them. Don't be distracted. Don't deny them. Recognize them. 2, remember that they and the conditions causing them are A, stressful, B, subject to change, and C, impermanent. And then 3, abandon welcoming the good or rebelling against the bad ways that people think of you or the pleasure, pain, gain, and loss that's inevitably part of every day. So it might be hard imagining being able to do this consistently, to remember these basically 3 things. 6, you count the ABC. So don't try to imagine doing it consistently. Just try doing it a few times. And then try a few more times. And then review how it's gone. Do you see the stress that's in the so-called good stuff, the praise or the good reputation? How did you remember that these wins would pass and change. Did it comfort your experience of the blame or disrepute to remember its impermanence? How did your mind work with that? What could you do differently for an even better result? You don't have to do this practice in any right way. Just try it. This is a very concrete way of practicing equanimity. Try it and watch how it goes. It will become more comfortable, I promise. And overall, so will you. Thank you.